This is the last episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism Season 4, but don't worry, we will be back in a few weeks for Season 5. So until then, enjoy the episode and we'll see you soon. Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is Blake Flayton, a columnist for the Jewish Journal and a social media commentator on American Jewish and Israeli political issues. He also works for the former member of the Knesset, Einat Wilf, and former ambassador to Israel from Canada, Vivian Berkovich, on projects to engage Israelis and Jews around the world with critical subjects. Blake, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well.
Good. It's really my pleasure to have you on. And look, I think many people will know you as one of the foremost voices and commentators on issues pertaining to Jews and anti-Semitism and Zionism. And on the latter point, I just wanted to ask, what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions right now surrounding Zionism?
That's a million-dollar question. And it's quite complicated, actually, but I'll try my best to make it simple. There's a lot of misconceptions about Zionism, whether they come from within the Jewish community or outside the Jewish community. I like to define Zionism with two sentences. The first sentence is the Jewish people's right to self-determination in their ancestral homeland. And the second is the continuation and the sustaining of a Jewish and democratic state within that ancestral homeland. I think that both of those factions need to be honored in order for you to get a full understanding of what Zionism is. And then if you wanted to be a little nerdy about it, you could say that Zionism is a political movement that was developed by the Jews really in the last 120 years or so that challenged our pre-existing ideas of what being Jewish meant. And how Judaism was to survive in the modern era, and really rebelled against all of those old standards, I would say, and giving us the ability to make our own choices and decide our own future. So it's a lot more revolutionary than people assume it is.
Mm. Well, on that first definition you gave, you're talking about this idea of indigeneity, and I think the concept of a group of people returning to their ancestral homeland is quite a progressive idea, which is why I think so many people are surprised when you see these pockets of progressive movements that are so vehemently anti-Zionist, with some even going as far as to label Zionism as a form of racism, which is a breach of the IHRA, the International Definition of Antisemitism. Why is that? Why are so many so-called progressive groups so hostile to Zionism?
Well, really, it goes back to the founding of the State of Israel. The Jews, like you said, have a right to live in the land in which they've always been associated with. You know, we have been known as Jews, and in different languages, it's just a variation on the word Jew. I think in Spanish, it's Judío, and obviously in German, it's Juden. We have been associated, we've been named after this piece of land for the last 2,000 years, if not more so. And so we have a right to live in this land, and we absolutely have a right to declare ourselves as sovereign in this land and to have a means of self-defense and self-reliance in this land, because we, and I believe this very strongly, are a nation just like any other nation, and therefore we have the right to a state to distribute resources amongst ourselves and to have a line of defense against attackers and invaders. So that's step one. A lot of people in the region, the 23 Arab countries who surround the Jewish state, and this, you know, is changing, we can hope. In the last couple of years, you know, with the Abraham Accords in 2020, there are signs that this is changing, and who knows what will happen with Saudi Arabia the next year or so. But the vast majority of people still in the region do not believe this. They do not believe that Jews have a right to live here or that they have a right to establish a country here. They view us as a white colonial usurpers of the true right to the land, which is exclusively of the Arabs, of the Arab Palestinians, to be more specific. They don't view Judaism as a legitimate nationality. They view Judaism as only a religion, and therefore without the same rights to a thriving civilization as other nations, in their own borders, in their own state. And basically, for the first, you know, 30 years of Israel's existence, this was this campaign of the Arab countries sounded very right wing. You know, it sounded Nazi-like, it sounded imperialist, it sounded violent, it said we're going to push the Jews into the sea, it said the Jews are cockroaches and swine, and, you know, we're going to obliterate Israel. And it was a campaign, it was a movement that nobody in the West who could ever call themselves liberal or progressive would ever support. And then, you know, it turned out to be a colossal failure, that strategy, because Israel kept winning wars. The international community was in support of Israel. And, you know, standing up for the Jews and standing up against anti-Semitism was a good progressive cause overseas. And then, you know, the Soviet Union enters stage left in somewhere in the mid to late 70s, and basically flips the language of anti-Zionism in order to make it more palatable to people in the West, to journalists and, you know, academics and activists and all of that. And I'm not going to, you know, pretend that things on the ground didn't give way to that as well. For instance, in 1967, Israel began occupying the West Bank, which, you know, changed geopolitics as well. But the Soviet Union took advantage of that to make the language of anti-Zionism sound as though it was a progressive fight for justice, a call for righteousness. And it's been going ever since because, you know, it's believable. They use the lingo, they use the words that that connect with people who style themselves activists, and it's been very successful, I would say. But in reality, it's just the same Nazi-like war against the Jewish right to self-determination that's been going on since 1948. The goal is the same, and that's from the river to the sea. There will not be a Jewish state. There will be a 24th Arab state in the region, which is, like I said, when you boil down to it, a militaristic kind of imperialist endeavor that seeks to deny a minority their rights.
Hmm. And you mentioned there how a lot of, you know, neighboring countries view Jews in Israel as white colonizers. And this rhetoric is something that we've seen in recent years on campuses, certainly in the United Kingdom, but also certainly in the United States as well. Why has this become such a hot button issue on university campuses to the extent that Jewish students have said they, you know, feel very unsafe?
Right. So this is actually in line with the tradition of how anti-Semitism has worked forever, because the anti-Semitism and anti-Semites kind of take advantage of the hot button issues of the day, and they connect Jews with those hot button issues in order to kind of whip up outrage amongst their supporters and get closer to their goals on campus. Those goals tend to be, you know, passing of BDS resolutions or isolating of Jewish organizations or simply just making individual Jews feel uncomfortable. You know, that needs to be recognized as the goal of people who antagonize Jews on campus. They're not really succeeding at, changing anything on the ground in Israel-Palestine and the region that they profess to care so much about. What they're really doing is marginalizing Jewish voices on campus and excluding Jews from the spaces in which they were once welcomed. And if that isn't Jew hatred, I don't know what it is. But yeah, so anti-Semitism has always operated this way. You know, when faith was the issue du jour, and spirituality and the afterlife were big aspects of the human condition, we were attacked with accusations that, you know, our faith and our lack of acceptance in the one true God was holding the entirety of humanity back from salvation. And then when, you know, culture and class and politics became the issues in modern enlightened Europe, we were accused of being, you know, too insular and being conniving and therefore holding other people down from business endeavors or for being communists or for being capitalists. The list goes on, and eventually, you know, being nationalists and then being internationalists. And now, you know, the progressive left in Western spaces is having this moment of, you know, mass reckoning with the consequences of colonialism and imperialism and racism, especially in countries like the United Kingdom, which of course has a long history of those types of things. And so there's a lot of guilt and there's a lot of, you know, emotion and grievance that goes along with that. And how do you channel guilt and grievance and emotion and tie it to an issue that is affecting a lot of people today? You somehow bring the Jews into it. That's been a strategy since time immemorial, as I just explained. And so that's what's happening now, because really, once you put a face on the evil that you're describing, it becomes a lot easier for people to rally against that evil and for people to become more passionate about addressing it and stopping it. You need a face, you need something to symbolize that evil, especially as it relates to our modern era. And they've found no better candidate than the State of Israel, because they think that, you know, the Jews in Israel look like the Jews that they see on campus, and they think that the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, you know, look like people of color in the West. And that, we can go into more into this later, but that is a extremely problematic construct, because one, it's not true, and two, it's imposing Western ideas of ethnicity, nationality, and race onto a region that most of them have never been to and most of them actually know very little about. But again, it's not about reality. It's about continuing an ancient tradition.
Mm. So given all of that, is it still possible to be a proud Jew in progressive activist circles in the States?
It depends which progressive activist circles. Like, you know, the term progressive is an umbrella term you will find within the confines of progressivism. People who I found accept you as a Jew and you know, welcome you into their space and will actually listen to what you have to say and your narrative and your story and your family's story, which is, of course, important. And then there were progressives, which are much farther to the left, that won't do all of those things and will go out of your way to make you feel uncomfortable, like they did with me in college. So it's really just it depends which progressive space and what cause they're advocating for, you know. But I do have to say that in the last couple of years, you know, we've seen sort of anti-Zionist ideology take over a lot of spaces, some spaces which, you know, were considered more moderate or reasonable just, you know, just a couple of years prior. I wrote about how when I was at university, issues that had nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict were always brought, you know, to the forefront and tethered to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whether that be a $15 minimum wage or whether that be, you know, reproductive health care for women or LGBT rights or, you know, legalization of marijuana, what criminal justice reform, that's a big one, you know, police brutality in the United States, any issue under the sun, the leaders of these organizations, of these spaces, found a way to make it about Israel. And so I will stick with what I said first, that it really depends on the space in which you find yourself and the ethics of the people involved. But it is a worsening problem because they're quite literally colonizing these different issues to make them about us, which is a scary trend.
Yeah, it is. You mentioned that you maybe you had some difficult experiences at college. Could you maybe go a bit more into that?
Yeah, so I got to college intent on kickstarting my career in politics. I went to school in Washington, D.C. because I wanted to work on Capitol Hill, and that's what I did. You know, I wanted to work for my congressman. I wanted to be involved in all of these different movements that were, you know, targeted against the Trump administration, but also against the diabolical forces in America that we were all very passionate about at the time. And like I said, in my freshman year, I discovered that I really couldn't put myself in a space, regardless of the issue that was being advocated in this space, without Israel becoming a part of it, becoming incorporated into the activism of this group of people. Whether I was on Capitol Hill, whether I was participating in a pride march in DC where the Star of David rainbow flag was banned by the protest organizers, who were Jewish, by the way, because it was a quote unquote nationalist symbol, or whether I was at a rally, you know, on my campus quad to support a $15 minimum wage for the janitorial staff on my campus. And then all of a sudden they invite up a member of Jewish Voice for Peace who starts talking about, Students for Justice in Palestine, which is an organization that probably many of your audience members know, to start talking about, you know, the oppression of Palestinians in Gaza and how this is tied directly to janitors at George Washington University not getting paid enough money, which is just riddled with anti-Semitic. It's just insane. It was insane to me. And remember, I got to college not knowing a whole lot about Israel. You know, I grew up with Israelis. I grew up in a Jewish community that was pro-Israel, but I had never really investigated the issue. But I knew instinctively that this was not politics. You know, that this was not policy that came out of the Knesset that, you know, we were objecting to. This was not a rational view of what was going on the ground in a region that was very far away. This was sort of the channeling of an issue through issues that we cared about. And it took some studying of anti-Semitism in my Jewish studies class that I was taking to realize that this is actually a pattern and not something out of the blue. And yeah, you know, on top of that, I just had some personal issues with people that I knew who were also involved in these spaces as well, who made sort of offhand comments any chance that they got about Zionists, which again just goes straight back to the Soviet Union, which state-sponsored anti-Semitism, but just replaced the word Jew with Zionist in the hope that that would make it more more appealing to a wider audience. And they succeeded because it certainly did. And so, it was difficult for me because the personal consequences were hard. You know, once I started talking about this, I lost friends, I lost colleagues, and, you know, very few people at school wanted to talk to me about it. I published an article in the New York Times documenting my experiences and the way that I felt about them, and not one professor reached out to me. And this was in the New York Times, this sort of expose about anti-Semitism on college campuses. And yet still, after that piece came out, not one faculty member or one of my professors reached out to me, including from the Jewish Studies Department, by the way. So you just see that, like, oh, so this is actually a much deeper issue than it looks on the surface, because all of these sort of dynamics, social dynamics, are wrapped up in it. And that's what makes you realize that it's not just about politics at all.
I mean, how the hell did you deal with that? And also, if someone else is going through that on a college right now, how can they deal with that?
Well, this little thing called the coronavirus happened, and I was actually sent away from school at the peak of all of this controversy. And so obviously COVID was horrible. COVID ruined lives. COVID had to, be fought. And we don't, we all wish, we all are grateful that we're in a post-COVID era. But I have to say that it was okay for me because I was sort of taken out of this environment and got to, move to New York and start a new life and breathe a little bit and get connected with other Jewish students who had experienced similar things and who were going through similar hardships. And then, I kind of started online activism during the pandemic because that's what everyone was doing during the pandemic. And I just, thought, why not me? I can scream on the internet as much as anyone. And so I started screaming on the internet. And it was incredibly cathartic, not only because I was getting attention in speaking about these issues, and people were supportive of me and making these sort of things public, but because of how many people, like I said, who I found who had gone through similar things and who had known firsthand the emotions that I had. And the feelings of isolation and bullying, really, that I encountered. And I used to feel guilty about that. Like I used to, in the years after college, I used to feel ashamed to say that I was bullied or that, people were being unfair because I never want to come across as complaining. I always, want to come across as someone who's looking at a situation very rationally and making decisions from there. But no, it is appropriate to use those words because that's what it is. It's personal. It's not political. It's personal. There are social dynamics that are involved. There's group dynamics that are involved and hierarchies that are involved, and all of it hits very deep and cuts very deep. And then I moved to Israel a year later, and then it just confirmed to me that no one who I was in touch with on campus had any idea what they were talking about, because there are issues here that they can't even begin to talk about, as I'm sure anybody who's watched the news or, has tuned into Israeli news over the last year is can attest to.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. To what extent was your move to Israel motivated by anti-Semitism in America?
So that's a really interesting question because I'm actually not sure. I think quite a bit. I think if I were to come to a conclusion, I would say quite a bit. And it's not just the anti-Semitism on college campuses, it's the anti-Semitism everywhere. The streets of Brooklyn are not safe for a Haredi Jew to be walking around in. I think it was just last week that a man was arrested for attempting to enter a synagogue with a semi-automatic assault rifle. And then he was killed by the police. Thank God that there were no casualties from that. And we're inundated with celebrities and public figures making obscene comments all the time. But personally, my specific brand of Judaism is not very observant. I did not grow up in a very observant household. And so I connect to Judaism, and I've really discovered this to be true about myself. I connect to Judaism through a shared sense of peoplehood and a shared sense of nationhood, and the culture and worldliness that comes out of a shared of collective responsibility and a sense of shared future for our people and shared history, of course, shared language, shared customs, shared piece of land. that's what Judaism means to me, and that's what Judaism was to me growing up. You know, like I mentioned before, I was very close with Israelis growing up, and my synagogue was like a lot of Reform synagogues in America, in which, you know, they advertised Birthright every summer. They, you know, brought the Israeli scouts in. They, you know, taught us how to make Israeli food, and we sang Israeli songs and did the and did folk dancing outside of our temple. And so that was what it was to me. And I'm realizing now that anti-Semitism that is directed at that, that says that you have no right to express Judaism in this way, you have no validity in showcasing your Judaism through this nationality aspect of it, that is also anti-Semitism. It's anti-Semitism, obviously, when people attack Jews for their religion, and it's anti-Semitism when, you know, 100 years ago or even less in Europe, people attack Jews for their constructed race or ethnicity. And it's also anti-Semitism in our own era when people attack Jews for their connection to the state of Israel. Because it's just the uncomfortable truth that in the post-war era, millions of Jews, not only in Israel, but overseas, use Israel and use Zionism as a way to feel particular, as a way to feel a part of the Jewish community, as a part of a collective, as you know, having something to offer other than assimilation, and sort of wiping away of any attachment to something unique. And so that's why the virulence, that's why the opposition against it is so virulent, right? Because it's what makes us different. And that's what's always animated our detractors. And so it doesn't need to be, you know, just like easily recognizable anti-Semitism in America that leads me to move to Israel. It's this very personal contemplation where it's this understanding of, I have a specific relationship with Judaism, and that specific relationship to Judaism is under assault, and I need to move to Israel because Zionism sort of offers a third way, and that's what it was intended to do. You know, it was intended to offer Jews an outlet to feel Jewish without necessarily having to be very religious, and following, you know, orthodoxy and faith, but also not assimilating into their outside culture. And not sort of flattening over their distinctiveness. And I think that is very much the case in the United States. That's ultimately why I decided to make Aliyah.
Mm. So now you live in Israel, and as mentioned, you are working for the Jewish Journal. You're a columnist, Jewish Journal, the LA-based Jewish newspaper. How have you found it?
I mean, I'm very lucky. Like, I'm a 23, I just turned 23 last week. So I'm a 23-year-old columnist, which I never thought I would be. You know, I used to write rants on Facebook when I was in middle school and high school about, you know, the latest drama in American politics. So I guess it's not too far-fetched, but I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to share my opinions with the world and about American Jewish issues, about Israeli Jewish issues, about global Jewish issues. It's a really awesome opportunity.
Do you think of yourself as primarily an activist, a commentator, a writer, or all of the above?
So that's a question that I struggle with a lot, because the line separating the three things you mentioned, activist, commentator, or what was the third thing you said? Activist, commentator, or
writer.
I mean, the lines between all of these things are extremely blurry. You know, how are you going to be an opinion columnist without having strong opinions? And how are you going to be a strong opinion? How are you going to have strong opinions without being some sort of activist? And then, of course, you need to figure out a way to make the sentences coherent along the way. So you kind of need to be an okay writer at the same time. And so, you know, these boundaries are fluid, I would say. You know, I call myself an activist because I guess that's objectively what I do, especially on social media, is, you know, sharing information and sharing content that I know that other people are going to want to share. and that will hopefully bring attention and bring traffic to the cause, whatever cause that I'm advocating for that day. And then, I kind of break it down into more academic language in the Jewish Journal, once a week or once every other week. And then I'm a commentator because, there's really important issues that are facing the Jewish world today, not only in Israel, but everywhere, as we've discussed. And, I have to add my two cents, not because I think it's worth anything, but because I'll go insane if I don't, because I have trouble sleeping at night because of just how many things that we have to deal with every day and listen to. The condition of the Jews has always been very stressful, and so why not pitch in and give your two cents?
You are such an activist. Do you have any advice for aspiring Jewish writers?
I would say, don't listen to what the non-Jewish world is telling you to do or be. The non-Jewish world should have very little say over how you connect with Jewish issues, how you perceive Jewish issues, and what you think about Jewish issues. If you're worried, if you want to, have a career or even are just interested in doing this as a hobby, getting involved in Jewish spaces and discussing important issues that are affecting our community today, you can't really take in consideration how the outside world is going to perceive you, because it's always going to be skewed, because the outside world always views us in a warped kind of manner. So you need to just go with it. You need to start writing, if that's what you want to do. I started as a freelance writer pitching to publications every week. I would get one response every 3 months, but that was worth it for me because I thought it was so exciting, that I would get my name in a paper, and eventually that started happening more and more. But that wouldn't have happened unless I just went with it. So if writing is your forte, then full send, hit the gas. If activism is your forte, I would say, go forward with social media and start making noise on social media. Social media, like, no one, this is something that I say to a lot of like high schoolers and college kids who come up to me, like, I want to start being more like vocal about like Jewish issues, but like, I'm afraid of what people who follow me on social media are going to say. They're going to unfollow me. I'm like, first of all, they're going to unfollow you, just letting you know. They unfollowed me. You'll survive. Like, it's going to be okay. There are things a lot more important than followers on social media. Two is, why are you placing so much importance in that? Like, you have a if you have a social media account, I promise you more people are going to care, even if it's people you haven't met yet, but more people are going to care about what you have to say about issues that affect a large amount of people than, pictures from your summer vacation. So use it in a way that's effective. It doesn't need to be like a personal blog. So that's the second thing. And the third thing I will say is just educate, 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 educate. If you are not reading a book right now because you're listening to this podcast, then as soon as this podcast ends, you should either be reading a book or listening to another podcast, which, because there's an infinite amount of Jewish related podcasts. We love to talk and we love to hear ourselves talk. And there's an infinite amount of content that you could be absorbing that will broaden your understanding of these critical issues, whether those critical issues be, the history of the Jewish people, the history of Zionism, the history of anti-Semitism, political discourse about Israel today, political is discourse about the place of diaspora Jewry today, testimonies about people who have gone through important life events, Zionists in the Soviet Union, Zionists in the Middle East, thinkers in pre-Holocaust Europe, pontificators on what the future of Israel-Palestine is and what the context of religion is in the Middle East. I mean, you really need to make an effort in order to be respected in this space. You really need to strive toward knowledge. I will say that, because the more knowledge you have in your arsenal, the more effective you're going to be at convincing people. And if you're not trying to convince people, doesn't matter. You still can't go wrong. You need, you know, there's a whole world out there of people talking about these issues. And if you want to be a part of it, you need to do a lot of listening and a lot of work on your end. And also speak Hebrew or Yiddish, like a Jewish language. Like I would recommend Hebrew, because a lot more people speak Hebrew, and also learning Yiddish, unfortunately, in 2023 has sort of anti-Zionist connotations, and I would not recommend that. But learn a Jewish language. I'm like working really hard to speak Hebrew now, and it's going okay, but it's essential. Like, if you're going to be involved in Jewish issues, speak a Jewish language.
You know, I was about to wrap this up, but you just said something. I got to ask you a follow-up question. Can you, yeah. I've never heard that. Can you expand on that? That learning Yiddish has anti-Zionist connotations?
Of course. So this is actually something that I ran into in college. Before the establishment of the State of Israel, there was a very prominent political group. I'm not going to call it a party because I guess it was a party. It wasn't in any like established parliament or anything, of course. But there was a Jewish political party in Eastern Europe called the Jewish Labor Bund, which was a socialist, anti-Zionist party. Their tagline was, you know, our home is everywhere that we live, or everywhere that we are is our home. They didn't need to go to Zion. They wanted to integrate into European society, and they thought that the future of Judaism, of the Jewish community, was safety through socialism. And they really treasured Yiddish as kind of the fabric of their identity, as the rallying cry of Jewish solidarity was Yiddish. That was really important to them. Yiddish culture, Yiddish music, Yiddish thought, Yiddish philosophy. And we've sort of seen a neo-Bundist renaissance in the last, I'm not going to say, you know, a couple years, because that's only since I've noticed it, but it's been a thing for a while, because you have Jews in the diaspora who are sort of marinating and cooking in these progressive spaces, because those are the communities which they've been brought up in. And they have been told that Zionism is racism, that Zionism is colonialism, that, you know, Jewish nationalism is evil and regressive. And so they search for a way to connect with their history and their people in a way that makes sense, not just for them, but in their communities as well. And they have found the Bundist aesthetic to be very attractive for a lot of reasons. And so there's this like weaponization of Yiddish against Hebrew as sort of like the language of the diaspora, the language of pure Judaism, Judaism that wasn't corrupted by Zionism and therefore wasn't corrupted by power. You know, it's a symbol of the powerless Jew, the shtetl Jew, the socialist Jew whose ideology did not save him from a gas chamber, which they never like to hear, but that's the truth. And so it's a shanda, really, because, you know, that's a Yiddish word in itself. It's a shanda, really, because Yiddish is not inherently anti-Zionist. In fact, Yiddish gave birth to Zionism. The original political Zionists in Europe who decided to pack up and move to Eretz Israel to begin kibbutzim, we're speaking Yiddish. So it's a language that all of us can treasure and that all of us can feel sentimental and nostalgic over. And it doesn't have a political ideology, and I don't think it should be weaponized on ideological lines.
That is really interesting. I really didn't know much about that. Only on this podcast will you hear that the phrase neo-Bundist Renaissance casually used. I love it. Blake, let me ask you, I'm going to ask you a question now that I ask all of our guests, which is, if someone who is not Jewish comes to you and says that they want to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, where should they start?
Follow me on Instagram. No, I'm kidding. Someone who is not Jewish wants to get involved in the fight against anti-Semitism, I would say to listen to your Jewish peers, to take in the stories of your Jewish colleagues, your Jewish friends, your Jewish classmates. That's very important. And, you know, respect our narrative and respect what we say about our history and our present and what we want our future to be. And, you know, we're not going to agree with each other always. The Jews are famous for not agreeing with each other. Anybody who's looking at what's happening in Israel can see that clear as day. That's going to continue forever, by the way. Like, I personally think that Jewish unity is a myth. It's never been a thing. It's never going to be a thing. We're too educated and too politically aware to ever be on the same page with each other. Kol b'seder, that's fine. But if you're a non-Jew looking in, recognize that and respect it as, you know, respect it as a natural thing that there's going to be disagreement among us. And find a way to support us all, you know, find a way to support all different streams of us, all different factions of us as an ally, and support Israel, support the existence of the state of Israel. You know, if you can disagree with Israeli policy all you want till you're blue in the face, Lord knows I do. But if you really want to be an effective ally, especially in the spaces where, you know, I experienced anti-Semitism and came from, speak out when people demonize Zionists and, you know, use that word flippantly, and speak out when people oversimplify a very complicated geopolitical problem, and speak out when it's insinuated or sometimes outrightly put forth, stated that the Jews don't have a right to a country, either because they're only a religious group, which is not true. I don't have a religious bone in my body, and yet here I am in Israel. My entire life revolves around Judaism. So obviously there are different ways, you know, to be Jewish. Speak out against when people say that, you know, the Jews are colonizers, because we do have a right to be here. We have an ancestral claim to this land and a right to self-defense here. And speak out against, you know, abject lies, you know, about genocide or about, you know, that we poison wells. And that comes from educating yourself, which I spoke about earlier.
Mm. And then go follow Blake on Instagram. Blake,
follow me on Instagram. Yeah.
Please tell the listeners, what have you got going on? What have you got coming up? And where can people find you?
Oh, God, I have a lot going on. I have a lot coming up. Right now, like we discussed, I'm writing for the Jewish Journal still, either a weekly or a biweekly column. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, just at Blake Flayton, BLAKEFLAYTON. And in the future, right now I have a podcast going with Dr. Einal Wilf, who's one of the most effective and articulate, I would say, defenders of Israel and Zionism in the 21st century. The podcast is called We Should All Be Zionists. Go give it a listen. I promise we'll have a new episode soon. Dr. Wilf is currently on vacation, but we're going to get started again right away. I'm managing the social media for the State of Tel Aviv magazine, which is a little bit more inside baseball, Israeli political issues. So if you're interested in that, you can check them out at stateoftelaviv.com. And in October, I'll be starting grad school, getting a degree in Israel in Middle Eastern and religious studies, which promises to be thrilling, as I'm sure you can know. So that's about it.
That is really exciting. Blake Flayton, thank you so much for coming on Podcast Against Antisemitism.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating, or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org.